This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, everybody, welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. This is your host, Charles Giuliani. We've got a very interesting guest this evening. Her name is Susan Lindauer. She's actually a former CIA asset. She's also the author of a new book, Extreme Prejudice, subtitled The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. So this is a very important topic. One that I wish more Americans were aware of. More Americans should be aware of this by now. We're looking back over the past 12 years of shenanigans that have been pulled in the wake of 9/11. And it's because most Americans are still yet unaware of what's been going on that, shenanigans continue to be pulled on us. So this is very important we be aware of this. So with no further ado, let's welcome Susan Lindauer. Welcome, Susan.
Hey, it's great to be on. Oh, I am hearing an echo back again. Sorry about this. I love your show.
Oh, are you a regular listener? Or?
Well, I've come on the People's Radio before, so I love you guys.
Oh, okay. I may, in fact, have interviewed. I don't know. I've interviewed so many people over the years, I can't keep track anymore. Are you still hearing the echo? I hope not.
It's coming in a little bit when I speak. That's okay. Let's just keep going.
Well, as far as I can tell, it isn't coming over the airwaves. So if it's maybe they can try to fix it back in the and if not, well, as long as it's not too distracting for you, hopefully it's something we can get through here. But anyway, before we begin, of course, we want to talk about your book here in a moment, but I'm interested in some of your background here as far as your CIA connection. What kind of work did you actually do with, and are you still with them at all in any capacity?
Well, you know something. It's really important for people to understand, because in this age when, you know, we have the fighting in Syria, we have Iran that's, you know, blowing up into, you know, World War III scenarios, and we've really bankrupted our country on these wars, and we tend to think that it's a hopeless situation, that there's an inexorable tide that's dragging us into conflict, and no matter what we do, it's going to keep pulling us until we're into it. And what I want people to understand is that is absolutely, it may be hard to change the future. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but we can definitely do this. There is never, in my experience, I was a back channel to Iraq and Libya at the United Nations from 1995 until 2003. And we had, in Libya, for example, we had tremendous success, and our ability to use back-channel dialogue was so effective that we essentially pushed back any conflict, any war scenario, for another 15 years. You know, we actually, you know, until Gaddafi was overthrown, until the Arab Spring, this situation, you know, we had 15 good years of peace. And it was because, you know, even though the American people had no idea what was going on, it was covert. And it needed to be covert. We had to protect it. But there was still that back-channel dialogue. And it's very effective. Same thing with Iraq. The tragedy about Iraq was that we had a peace option on the table. It's outlined in my book, Extreme Prejudice. And it would have resolved all of the conflict with the United States. It would have achieved all of the U.S. objectives. It was not a lack of courage or leadership. It was not a lack of vision. The intelligence community had a very good understanding of what had to be achieved. and the Iraqis were quite willing to give it to us. But there was a decision, you know, among the Bush people that they wanted war no matter what. And so it was not a I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not a failure of diplomacy. It's not a failure of communication that produced it. It was not economic failures that produced it. It was a decision, a choice that was made to throw out peace as a solution to the problem.
How was Bush viewed, you know, amongst your colleagues at the time when all this was going on? You know, was it kind of mixed, or was it skewed in either direction, pro or con?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting that you ask that, because, of course, that the mainstream, the public, with regards to Iraq, deeply opposed the war. This was one of the greatest shows of democracy the world has ever seen. You know, the anti-war demonstrations globally were astounding. And all of these people reached the same conclusions without ever receiving a single intelligence debriefing. Common sense told the whole planet that this was a catastrophic, would be a catastrophic mistake, and that it would be a very expensive war, that we would fire up terrorism, we would create, you know, discontent, and the Iraqi people would never tolerate violent occupation of their country. They would fight back, and that's exactly what happened, and all of the people saw it. So what did the intelligence community think of it? The public was told a lie. The public was told, when George Bush was unfortunately such a coward that he couldn't take responsibility for his own decision-making, that he turned around and said, well, it was bad intelligence that led us to this point. The intelligence community, you know, got their facts wrong, and they made up this story about these weapons of mass destruction. That is absolutely not true.
Sure.
In fact, there were the neocons in the intelligence community who were saying it, who were like gung-ho for a war. But the rest of us were saying, this is ridiculous. There's no way that Saddam Hussein possibly could have developed weapons, because the sanctions are so rigid. They don't even have chairs. They don't have lights. They don't have light bulbs. They don't have pencils for their schools. And you're making up this story that they somehow have all this technological superiority. They don't have any computers. They don't have chairs and tables. Their homes are emptied of furniture. They scarcely have running water, and yet you're saying that they have their pipeline in oil infrastructure is degraded so badly they can barely pump oil, and you're saying that they have these fancy weapons of mass destruction? That's ridiculous. That's absolutely preposterous. What did we think of George Bush? The neocons thought he was weak and could be manipulated. The rest of us saw that he was weak and a bully, and he needed to knock people off their balance, because, of course, if you're dumb and stupid and mediocre, you don't want anybody of talent around you showing that they know more than you do. And so instead of empowering people to be their best and to give America their best and to solve problems that he was not capable of solving, George Bush tried to tear everybody down and tried to keep everybody off balance so that they would be fighting each other. And so when we knew my team gave advance warning about 9/11, but I learned about 9/11 from the CIA, from my own CIA handler. So we received the information from the CIA. We gave the reports back to the CIA. And I personally had contacted the offices of Attorney General John Ashcroft and the Office of Counterterrorism in August of 2001, a month before the attack.
So you actually dealt with him firsthand, Ashcroft?
Yeah. Because I had been doing anti-terrorism for so long, I had private phone numbers inside the office in case anything was going on and I couldn't reach my handlers. I could immediately alert the Justice Department. And I could alert top people in the Justice Department so there could be an emergency reaction to it. So I invoked this for 9/11 in August of 2001. I contacted them and jumped on it and tried to get this to tried to make something positive happen. We asked for what's called an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies. Regarding any fragment of intelligence involving airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center. We said we believed it would complete the cycle of the 1993 World Trade Center attack, and that the attack was considered imminent, and it should be considered an emergency priority for all agencies to respond back. And so that's why you hear that the FBI office in Minneapolis, of all places, responded by sending their intelligence back through all agencies, because that's what you do. They notified when Mousawi crossed over from Canada and they picked him up, they notified the FAA, they notified the Secret Service, they notified all the other agencies in addition to the Attorney General's office, and that's what you do. And that was a direct response to my request for an emergency broadcast alert. That's how they handle it. So,
The subtitle of your book, obviously you're not too impressed with the post 9/11 legislation that has been passed for, the Patriot Act, for example, an obvious power grab. Ashcroft was highly instrumental in that, as I'm sure you're aware. And, in your dealings with him, did you get that impression at the time, or did you come to that conclusion later that this guy might just be actually unpatriotic in his push for the Patriot Act?
Well, I thought the whole Bush administration was completely, at the time, I thought they were malevolent and mediocre, and I could see immediately that the FBI was, that the Justice Department was engaged in a power grab with the intelligence community, trying to eat their lunch, trying to take over their mission of anti-terrorism, so that they could try to increase their budget and to try to hire more staff. Because, of course, the bureaucracy exists to expand. And so they tried to attack our intelligence when, in fact, the CIA had warned the Justice Department and had appealed to the Justice Department for assistance, and our efforts were rejected. And so it wasn't our fault that they didn't act. It was their fault that they didn't act. But then they were so corrupt. Ashcroft was so corrupt, and that he ended up, trying to protect his lies and his deception by arresting, I was arrested on the Patriot Act. I was the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act. Others lost their jobs or were threatened with loss of pensions. My CIA handler was rewarded with $13 million in emergency that he stole off emergency appropriations for the 9/11 investigation. But you see that, it's worse than just Ashcroft being failure.
I'm just curious. Did you leave the CIA of your own accord, or were you invited to leave?
I was an asset. So it's kind of how they do it is like they stop taking your calls. But the thing is, what happens is that for example, my CIA handlers had told me, one of the very last conversations we ever had, he said to me, "Susan, we will always." I had just been to the Iraqi embassy, and we'd been putting together a comprehensive peace framework, and we were working on getting the weapons inspectors into Iraq. And I had told, and I came and I said, should I put in the letter to Andy Card, Andy Card was my cousin, the chief of staff to George Bush. Yes. And I said, how much of this should I put into the letter? And he said, Susan, you can give it to the letter to us or not. We know everything you're doing. And he said, even if I was not able to communicate with you for any reason, we would still always be following this. We know you're going to complete the task. We've given you instructions, and we expect you to follow through. And it turned out that was the last communication we ever had.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah. Let me ask you something. I got the impression early on when you were talking about Bush and that it was your understanding, or at least the general understanding among your colleagues, that the whole push for the war in Iraq was basically a screw-up and George was misguided. In light of things that have emerged, though, for example, you've got Paul Wolfowitz admitting to Ted Koppel on March 5th of 2003, 2 weeks before the Iraq War broke out. He talked about, you know, the PNAC group, Project for the New American Century.
Yeah.
And he said, this isn't a conspiracy that we're trying to hide. He says anybody can go to our website and see that we were planning the Iraq War over a year ago, a year and a half ago, you know, in the September 2000 report, Rebuilding America's Defenses. He made reference to that.
Yeah.
And he actually said that, yeah, you know, we talked about going into Iraq to seize its oil reserves. He wasn't hiding the fact that, you know, they had this agenda in place even before Bush was in office.
Well, that was PNAC. You know, that PNAC should not have been in control of the White House. The PNAC is their pinochles.
But I guess my question
PNAC
is...
PNAC or pinochles.
Yeah, right. How ignorant, though, do you think Bush was of this? You know, he didn't seem
I think that
agenda,
Bush was a very stupid man. I mean, people have, you know, some of the Republicans have... some of the Republicans have tried to say, oh, he's really smart. Oh, he wasn't. He was really dumb. And he was afraid of his dumbness. So, like a bully, he acted like a bully, and he was not a high functioning leader. He didn't understand consequences, and he didn't, you know. And we all know this about him now. But you see the same thing with Obama, and you see these leaders who are. It appears to me that when they feel weak. And President Clinton was the exact opposite. President Clinton was a strong, confident leader who made a I may have disagreed with some of what he did, but I knew, and he may have responded sometimes to Monica Lewinsky, and some of his things may have been pushed at him for that reason. He may have used some things to distract from that crisis. However, he was a strong leader. He was in charge of his White House. And George Bush and even Obama are not. The weaker they are, the more likely they are to use drones, the more likely they are to go to war. They allow these people to push them towards agendas that shouldn't have anything to do with their own, with a cause for America.
Yeah. Well, anyway... so many directions I wanted to go here. I recall Ron Paul talking about the Patriot Act when it was first passed. And by the way, I love this story. John Ashcroft, I remember he was basically threatening Congress to pass the Patriot Act just a month after, less than a month after 9/11. And essentially he told them, if you don't pass it, there's going to be another attack and we're going to hold you responsible because you didn't give us the tools we needed to fight terrorism. He even said that, you know, we have sleeper cells all over the U.S., Less than a year later, the FBI came out with a report, as you may recall, and said that, you know, they found no evidence of any sleeper cells anywhere in the U.S. So he was basically, you know, just making this up, pulling this.
It was fear-mongering.
Yeah.
Again, you have a weak man who had ignored, his personal staff had ignored the warnings about 9/11. We had begged them for help. They did nothing to help us. It was poor coordination from the FBI, and a refusal to listen to intelligence. And then the FBI had recognized that the bureaucracy of the Justice Department recognized they could expand their budget authority and get more money and more power and hire more employees.
Yeah.
And then they needed to attack the CIA, which is burdened by non-disclosure requirements anyway. And so they attacked the CIA and tried to, you know, shift the blame onto us. But it was just like the weapons of mass destruction. The CIA, you know, there were some PNAC crowd people, but this is a healthy, vibrant democracy. And I can assure you the intelligence community is not full of shrinking violets. You know, wallflowers, you know, if there's something going on, people will jump right in and tell you what they think. You know, and you may not like what they think. You may not like to hear it, but they're not going to be quiet about it because that's their sphere of authority, and they know they have great detail, vast quantities of minutia intelligence on this stuff, and they can tell you exactly how it's breaking down from one minute to the next. And again, you may not like what you're hearing, but I can tell you that the intelligence community was not nearly as stupid and passive. And that was the problem for the Bush administration. And that's why they have been on the offensive. The Bush administration went on the offensive because they had to, you know, they made an example of me, for example, so that others would be afraid to come out and they'd say, look at her. She was the best of the best, and look what we're doing to her. We are destroying this woman. If you come out and attack our policy, we'll come after you too.
I got to be honest, Susan. I wish I could share your optimism about 9/11 being something unforeseen that they didn't act upon.
No. It was foreseen. We did foresee it.
Well, no. What I'm saying is, I think it goes deeper than that. For example, if you look at Zbigniew Brzezinski's 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard.
Yeah.
On page 211, he actually said, we need to go into Eurasia in the coming years to seize the rich oil and natural gas reserves in the Caspian Sea and the rich mineral deposits in the mountains of Tora Bora. And he said, in order to do this, to catalyze the American public behind us in support of this agenda, we need to have a massive, widely perceived direct external threat. To me, he's talking there about an actual government orchestrated fake.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know how you feel
do
about
I
that.
Do I think 9/11 was an inside job? Absolutely.
Oh, you do?
Absolutely did it. Like I said at the beginning, I learned about the 9/11 attack from the CIA. And I reported it back to the CIA, but when I was told to ask the Iraqis if they knew anything, they responded that the only chatter about 9/11 was coming from the CIA, and that it was coming from us, that we were the originators of the story. So anytime Jordan talked about it, or Egypt talked about it, or Germany talked about it, because other intelligence agencies were picking up on it, but everything always came back to us.
They're both dead, Gaddafi and Chavez.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I find that rather puzzling. Or then again, not so puzzling, I suppose. But I'm glad you said that, because having worked within the CIA circles, you know, the intelligence circles, was that a popular sentiment? Was there a lot of suspicion that it might actually be, a government-involved attack?
Well, I think that not initially. I think that initially we were amazed at how fast they jumped on the names. The fact, you know, it was an extraordinary thing that they immediately knew who had done it. Oh, look, we found the passport on the ground. Look, this is a nice, clean, little, neat passport. Everything else has
been
burned
juvenile.
To a
juvenile,
Yeah, it's like the single bullet theory in the JFK assassination. Everybody knows that that's not true. Everybody knows it's not true. And we also know that Mohammed Atta called his father the day after 9/11 and told him he was still alive.
And we know that
a lot of these people were assets of the CIA. And
eight
so you have
the,
to...
The named hijackers, actually, eight of them have been found to still be alive, according to mainstream media.
Yes.
And what gets
who
me...
Who died on those airplanes?
Me, Susan, is the fact that the FBI has not, updated their list. They were asked by the London Guardian, shortly after 9/11, they had interviewed Salem El-Hamzi, who was still alive living in Saudi Arabia. And so they called the FBI. They said, hey, what's going on? We're finding some of these hijackers that you named still alive. And they said, oh, yes, it's been a complicated investigation. We think some of them were using fake passports. It's going to take some time to iron out the details. Okay, fine. That's understandable. This is a short time after 9/11. But why is it now, over 12 years later, they're still, or almost 12 years later, they're still touting these same 19 names? They haven't updated the list.
Yes, they've never updated the list. They can't update the list because, of course, then they'd have to admit that the list was a fabrication.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, but I think that at this stage, the reason, you know, people say, well, you know, 9/11 happened 12 years ago, and what we have to worry about, the reason that 9/11 will always have relevance is that they're going to use another, it is very likely that they would use another tactic like 9/11 to try to draw us into war with Iran.
Sure.
Or Syria.
Well, and Hillary, as I'm sure you're aware, Hillary Clinton pretty much came out and said that very thing.
Yes, she did. She said that there should be a false flag operation as soon as possible, so we could get it over with and get on into Iran, and then we could go in and do what she wanted us to do. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I tell you what, we've got a couple more minutes, I guess, before we got to pause for a break, after which time we've got quite a few questions coming in. I got to tell you,
please,
I've never seen so many...
I'd love to answer questions.
Yeah, they're coming in via text. I'll be reading them to you. But I've never seen so many questions, especially in the first half of the show, come in for a guest.
Please, go ahead and start asking them right now.
Okay, sure. I guess it's because of your background, having worked with the CIA. A lot of people are anxious to ask.
Absolutely.
You. Yeah, we can take at least one before the break. This comes from Ed in Illinois, and he asks, Susan, how many people in the government do you think really know that 9/11 was an inside job, and why are they remaining silent? Well, I think we can take a good guess at the second part of that, but anyway.
Everybody has been threatened with losing their jobs or losing their pensions. Like if they're forced to retire, they wouldn't have a government pension. Some people were bribed and paid off. I would say that before 9/11, probably 150 to 200 people knew about it at the highest levels of government.
Yeah.
George Tenet has said that there were 105 briefing papers in the White House, and these were circulated widely. So I think that we should presume that there was a vast number of people who expected this. It was like a buzz that was going on in the intelligence circles. Maybe you know 200 or 300 people knew, that may not sound like a lot, but if you're thinking of a bureaucracy, and that these are people who are every single one of these people has the capability to do something about it. They're not like, pardon me, no offense to the ordinary Americans, but these are not people who are just like man on the street who hear it of something. This is like the Attorney General who's able to do something about it, the head of the Office of Counterterrorism who's able to do something about it. Probably 200 or 300 people, I would say, could have taken action in their own name, in their own right, to put a stop to this.
Sure.
And that's 300 people who I don't know how they could live with themselves. They must live in shame over this stuff.
Very, very interesting. Before we pause for the break, I'm sure you recall another comment by Paul Wolfowitz. He was interviewed in May of 2002 in, I'm trying to think now what magazine it was, Vanity Fair. And he said that the reason given for the war, weapons of mass destruction. Of course, by then, most people were starting to question the whole thing anyway. But he said the reason given, weapons of mass destruction, was concocted for bureaucratic reasons. It's something we all agreed upon that the public would be able to accept as a legitimate excuse for the war. In other words, he was admitting they lied. Of course, we all know that now. But that's an astonishing admission from the Deputy Director of Defense.
Yeah. They needed something that they could sell to the public that the public could swallow as an excuse. What's going to be a passable excuse?
Yeah.
And it was just the stupidest. I mean, we all know this was a very dangerous mistake. And then what has angered me so much is that these men who forced us into war, you know, it couldn't even take, I mean, at least Paul Wolfowitz, he was totally wrong, of course, I'm totally opposed to his politics, but he did take responsibility for his actions, at least by telling what he'd done, admitting what he had done. Others, like George Bush and my own cousin Andy Card, who was the chief of staff to the White House, decided that they would then blame the intelligence assets for our failure to bring them, help correct the mistakes and the assumptions in the war planning. And Jane Harman, who was, don't think I'm only attacking the Republicans, guys. Jane Harman was the Democrat, ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, and had been chair of the committee when the Democrats were in power. And she gave blistering speeches saying, if only the CIA assets had spoken up and corrected our mistakes in planning. If they knew that we were misinforming the public, they should have corrected us. Well, I was arrested because I did correct them. And when they decided they were going to lie, they were like, get this woman, Susan Lindauer, out of here. Because if she, our alibi will collapse in 30 seconds if she starts telling the whole world what she did. And so they arrested me and they lied. They locked me in prison on a Carswell Air Force Base.
What a scandal. I tell you what, Susan, why don't we hold off on that until after the break?
Yes.
We're kind of run over a little bit here. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana. And it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. And learn how you can help. Go to normal.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
Build, destroy.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction, as guests from various realms of interest share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Our guest again this evening is Susan Lindauer, former CIA asset, author of the book Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. Before we continue, I wanted you to have, to finish your story about your arrest, your scandalous, ridiculous arrest under the Patriot Act. But first, I wanted to give you a chance to plug any websites or, you know, where people can go and get your book, obviously Amazon.com. But is there anything else you wanted to direct people to?
You can get it on Amazon and Kindle, and it's available internationally. We're going to have a French edition out and a Japanese edition soon. And RT Television came out in January and taped me for a 5-part series that's going to be broadcasting in April. So keep your eyes open for that. I'm happy to answer your questions.
How many copies has John Ashcroft ordered?
Well, I tell you, the people of Texas have been some of my biggest purchases. So you'd be surprised who knows about my story.
Oh, watch out, George! Your neighbors are keeping an eye on you.
Yeah, that's right.
So finish the story now. You were telling us about your arrest under the Patriot Act. That sounds very interesting.
Well, I was the had done two things. I had requested to testify on Capitol Hill about the real facts of Iraqi pre-war intelligence and Iraq's cooperation with the 9/11 investigation, and I had also sent out a fax to every member of Congress, Democrat and Republican alike, reminding them of the Iraqi peace option and saying, "Don't even think of blaming the intelligence community for this, because we did a great job, and you chose to ignore the intelligence and listen to the Iraqi exiles. We told you the Iraqi exiles are terrible liars. No one in the intelligence community with any integrity actually believes those knuckleheads, and we warned you that you shouldn't believe those knuckleheads." Well, Congress became alarmed. They realized that they were not going to be able to hide from the public. And this was the Democrats as well as the Republicans. They realized that some of them would lose their jobs. They'd be fired from Congress. You know, that would be a tragedy for humanity if they got thrown out of office. So they decided that the solution would be not better decision making, but to arrest me, and then if I was arrested, and I could be silenced and gagged, and I wouldn't be able to tell the public my story. And of course, at that time, unfortunately, the corporate media was still very powerful, and the internet media was very weak. This was how long ago this was. This was in 2004. So, you know, the internet media was still mostly private blogs. You know, a lot of people were, you know, like they had their family blogs, like, you know, their weekend travel kind of excursions kind of stuff. But they didn't have, like, powerful internet radio at that point. It was just developing. It was still coming along. So the corporate media had so much power. And, of course, now, thank God, that's shifted. And it's completely reversed. But my story was one of those that really saw the changing of the guard and was really deeply impacted by the failure of the corporate media. And then was as the pendulum swung and lifting the water was rising, maybe that's a better way of putting it. The water was rising under the internet, you know, my boat rose with that. And so the corporate media was no longer able to threaten me and harass me and stop me from telling my story. I had another vehicle to tell the story, and now people started to say, "What the hell is she talking about? What do you mean we knew about 9/11? I mean, we knew about 9/11? You know, in 5 years of indictment, I was allowed exactly one hearing after 4 years of indictment. I was allowed one evidentiary hearing with two witnesses, and they prohibited us from having three. There was only two allowed. And the first one was a congressional chief of staff, Kelly O'Mara, who worked for Congressman Andrew Forbes of Long Island, and she confirmed that she'd known me for many years, and she'd never seen any sign of mental instability, And she also knew my defense intelligence handler, and she was very well aware that he was intelligence and that we had a very long relationship, and there's no way I was making that up. The second witness, of course, confirmed the 9/11 warnings. Well, the New York, and this was, you know, a mind-blowing, mind-boggling revelation. The next day, the New York Times reported that I stuck my tongue out at the prosecutor. And regurgitated the whole lie that I was a religious maniac, that I suffered nonstop hallucinations, that I believe in angels. I do believe in angels. I do believe in God. For those atheists out there, you're going to be very disappointed. But I do. I do believe in God. But you know what? That doesn't mean anything. It has nothing to do with this case, you know? And it had nothing to do with whether I should be found guilty or innocent. But the New York Times blistered me, and then the blogs came in, and Michael Collins wrote this great headline: 9/11 prediction revealed at Lindauer hearing, and it the blogs went wild. It flamed the blogs all over the blogs. It was like a wildfire. It was like, you know, and now you see. And then the New York Times was held up for being a liar, for having completely, completely deceived the public. And this is their own hometown. This was the World Trade Center. This was their own hometown that they were deceiving. And it's just, you know, you see that the blogs just coming on so strong. This is democracy. This is going to save, this is what's saving us right now. But I would never even, I don't read the New York Times, I don't watch Fox News Channel, I don't watch CNN or MSNBC, because I know it's propaganda.
I watch it for comic relief, that's about it.
Well, that's good, as long as you know that it is comedy.
Pretty tragic comedy. I have to agree, your assessment of the spiritual realm. The government has helped me to become a believer. I know the world is filled with demons.
Yeah.
So I certainly can concur with your belief there. Anyway, we got a bunch of questions here, and we only got about 10 or so more minutes, so let's see if we can squeeze a bunch of these in here. James, somewhere in the U.S., asks, is neoliberalism a threat to democracy?
Oh, how do you define neoliberalism?
I was just going to say, it depends how you define that. Yeah, that's kind of a broad term.
I don't know. Let me just tell you something. I live in a town called Tacoma Park, which is supposed to be a bastion of liberal activism. I will tell you that I think of these people, of my own neighbors, as being do-nothing Democrats. I think they're very passive. I think that it is a threat because they're not active in anything. I think that when you have anybody who says that they believe something who doesn't actually do it and stand by it, then it's like Bill Maher used to tease, and I don't know what you think of Bill Maher. I have very mixed feelings about him too.
Yeah,
a lot of people really hate him. A lot of people really hate him, but he said, you know, he used to, during the election, he said, you know, I wouldn't mind Obama so much if he was really a Democrat, if he would actually stand up and fight for the Democratic causes, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
Nobody's really doing anything for the Democrats. So is neoliberalism a threat? I would say it's more passivity that's a threat. I think the worst thing right now is that our public is so unattached to our country. And you don't have to be attached to the government. Yeah, who needs the government? It's our country we need to be concerned about.
Yeah.
It's not Washington.
Agree.
It's the society we live in.
You can say the same about Bush, too. He professed to be a conservative. We would have been a lot better off if he actually was a conservative as far as conserving, our economy, our borders.
There you go.
Yeah. There's nothing conservative about that.
Yeah.
We just get labels in this country anymore. That's all
we
get. Anyway, Joe in North Carolina asks, can Susan tell us how real terrorist threats are to America today? And who, in your opinion, is the biggest threat to America?
The FBI. The FBI is the creator of, truly, To answer both of those questions in one word, the FBI has been creating terrorist threats all around the country. They are recruiting them on the internet. They are providing technical advice. They're luring them in.
At least elements within the CIA as well.
Well, no. I think that, but within the United States, within the territorial United States, they have they're creating phony terrorist plots all over the country.
No question.
So that they can exaggerate this phony delusion, this fantasy that we're still under threat from like some either a lone gunman or some radical group that these people wouldn't do anything if they weren't being pushed.
Yeah.
It's like young men who are being like reeled in, and I don't like that. When I worked in anti-terrorism, we dealt with people who were committed terrorists. There were only 200 to 300 individuals who were true hardcore dedicated believers who were willing to destroy any symbol of the United States. There are more who opposed Israel. Now I'll give you that. But of the people who were willing to, you know, die to destroy symbols of the Americans of America, there were only 200 or 300 on the planet before 9/11. Now I would say there's probably 3,000 to 5,000.
One case that comes to mind, of course, is Bruce Ivins. You know, who the FBI set up to take the fall for the anthrax attacks. He had absolutely nothing to do with it. That was
poor
not
guy.
His area of expertise. And just as he's getting ready to testify, he winds up dead, and they claimed it was a suicide. Give me a break.
Yes.
Yeah. What a scam.
That's right. If you ever hear that I have committed suicide, I want you to laugh in their face, and I want you to know that I have clawed their eyes out while they were trying to kill me. There is
really
nothing suicidal in me at all. Anybody who tries to kill me, I will beat the crap out of them while they're trying to kill me. I will take maximum, they will have maximum damage, as much damage to them as I can.
Yeah. I want to squeeze as many as we can
questions
here. We got John, I'm skipping a couple because they're pretty much rehashes of some of the other questions. John in the UK asks, does Susan think 19 Arabs were behind the attacks on 9/11?
No. No, I don't. I don't think so. I think that they were, in that case, I think they were, the CIA used assets and probably like a very similar to one of these FBI operations. They identified some unhappy people whose names we will never know, and then they turned some other Arab people onto them and set up the whole thing and kind of drew in two or three unhappy people, and the rest of them were all manufactured. The whole thing was manufactured from start to finish. I do believe that there was a hijacking conspiracy, but I think we created it, we trained them, we provided funding for them. Mohammed Atta used cocaine, he went to strip joints, he drank alcohol.
Sure.
He ain't no jihadi. I mean, I've met jihadis, and they are, so conservative, so absolute pure. They think of themselves as being absolutely pure.
Well,
it's very important.
The FBI initially claimed that they got these 19 names from, the passenger manifests and whatnot, mm-hmm. but those names weren't on the passenger manifest. And
That's
then later,
right.
when they realized, oh, the public's onto us, they changed their story midstream. Years later, in April of, I think it was 2006, they began claiming, oh, no, we got all the information from documents in Atta's, unchecked bag. Oh, wait just a minute. They had already released all of the contents of Atta's bag years earlier, and nothing was mentioned about a list of hijacker names in that bag.
That's right. Mohammed Atta was a front. he was a recruiting tool, is my opinion.
Yeah.
And the guys, they were patsies. I think that the CIA, I think that there were some patsy, I'm prepared to believe that there were some patsy hijackers who were recruited and trained. And this is where it gets to be an inside job, because they actually required some training and technical assistance and financing to do this. And somebody was paying Mohammed Atta's bills big time. Though Mohammed Atta actually survived the attack, isn't that extraordinary? The towers are destroyed, but Mohammed Atta walks away.
Well, why not? If you get that passport that was found unscathed.
Yes.
Maybe he landed in the streets unscathed, too.
I know. Parachute, somehow. Yeah. It's just, the story is just, it doesn't, I do believe, now some people do not believe that an airplane hit the World Trade Center. I do believe an airplane hit the World Trade Center. I'm not a no plane theory person, but it was definitely staged by the government.
Right.
I absolutely believe the whole thing was staged by the government.
I question as to whether or not it was a commercial airliner, but something obviously
hit. There you go. That's it. That's another question. Yeah. Was it a commercial airliner or a drone?
Right. Anyway,
you know,
John,
that it could have been a drone, but it was whatever it was an airplane that was staged. This was planned out by the United States government.
Mark Birnbach, a Fox reporter, was there live that morning, and he said whatever it was, referring to the second plane that hit the second tower. He says, whatever it wasn't a commercial airliner. It didn't have any windows. That was interesting. It had an unusual blue logo on it. He said, it didn't look like any plane I've ever seen in any of our airports. And you have a woman looking up at it as it's crashing, and she says, that wasn't a commercial airliner. You know, so zombies.
There you go. Yeah. There you go.
Anyway, we got Josh in California. He asks, do you think Weapons Inspector David Kelly was murdered?
He's the British.
Yeah.
The British one, yes. He was going to expose, or he was in the process of exposing, yes. Let me tell you something. The British are big on killing assets who talk. That's what they usually do. they don't arrest them, they kill them. Yes.
Right. Sure. Al in Niagara. Looks like we might get all these questions in after all. Alan Niagara Peninsula, he asks, how did in your opinion, how do you think the WTC towers fell?
Controlled demolition.
Yeah.
Judy Wood has a theory that it was directed energy.
Judy Wood.
No, I don't know her, but
well,
I'm acknowledging her theory, but there's no way that, architects and engineers is absolutely correct. There's no way in physics that a jet fuel fire could have sparked the collapse of the towers and converted it into dust. This requires a thermatic explosion. Sulfur and a compound that actually converts steel to dust, and that's a thermite explosion.
Okay.
Now I will tell you that I was told before 9/11. The word before 9/11 was that it would involve miniature thermonuclear devices. So in our case, we believed that the airplanes would be a 1-2. We always believed, and I realize that a lot of your audience don't believe in the airplane theory at all, and I get that. But what I'm saying to you is that the official story that was created before the attack, we always said that there would be airplane hijackings, and it was very specific. We said airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center using possibly a miniature thermonuclear device, because we always believed that the explosions that would bring down the towers. And there was always this belief that there would be you see what I mean? And so what I see 9/11 as is a cover and deception operation. All of the eyes are on the public's eyes are on the airplanes. It's like a magician trick. The eyes are on what the left hand is doing, but the real action is on the right.
Sure. I tell you what, unfortunately we've run out of time. There was a few more things I wanted to talk about, but anyway, maybe we can get you back on. I really appreciate you taking the time out. Fascinating interview. It's always good to get an insider's perspective, especially when you're skeptical of the official story, like I believe a good deal of the American public now is. It's kind of split, I guess, between those who think the government did it and they just simply sat back and let it happen. But nevertheless, this is a healthy skepticism.
Well, I think that it's more than passivity. It required passivity, but it also was an active engagement. Yes. I'd love to come back on and talk about the Patriot Act, because
oh, yeah,
I think that's a real
one
threat.
One of the main thrusts of your book, yeah. Great. Well, once again, folks, check her book out, Extreme Prejudice. Again, her name is Susan Lindauer, L-I-N-D-A-U-E-R. You can just go on Amazon.com and look it up there. Thanks again, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Okay, folks, that's it for this evening. Join us next week. We're going to be having Anne Wright on. She's a former U.S. ambassador and a peace activist, so that should be another great interview. In the meantime, have a great week. We'll see you next week, folks. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.